But it is, brethren and sisters, to see tonight before us such a large number of brethren and sisters and young people. For surely we have been blessed to enter into the drama and the tragedy of this faithful and courageous man, Jonathan, whose love was wonderful. And tonight we come to consider Jonathan the intercessor, earnest entreaty and bitter separation. Let us begin by singing together hymn number 17. Anthony Steele will lead us in the reading of 1 Samuel chapter 20 from verse 24 to verse 42. Reading the 1 Samuel chapter 20, commencing at verse 24. So David hid himself in the field, and when the new moon was come, the king sat him down to eat meat. And the king sat upon his seat, as at other times, even upon a seat by the wall. And Jonathan arose, and Abner sat by Saul's side, and David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul spake not anything that day, for he thought, something hath befallen him. He is not clean. Surely he is not clean. And it came to pass on the morrow, which was the second day of the month, that David's place was empty. And Saul said unto Jonathan his son, wherefore cometh not the son of Jesse to meat, neither yesterday nor today? And Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. And he said, let me go, I pray thee, for our family hath a sacrifice in the city, and my brother he hath commanded me to be there. And now, if I have found favour in thine eyes, let me get away, I pray thee, and see my brethren. Therefore he cometh not unto the king's table. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said unto him, thou son of the perverse, rebellious woman, do not I know that thou hast chosen the son of Jesse to thine own confusion, and unto the confusion of thy mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse liveth upon the ground, thou shalt not be established, nor thy kingdom. Wherefore now send and fetch him unto me, for he shall surely die. And Jonathan answered Saul his father, and said unto him, wherefore shall he be slain? What hath he done? And Saul cast a javelin at him to smite him, whereby Jonathan knew that it was determined of his father to slay David. So Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger, and did eat no meat the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David, because his father had done him shame. And it came to pass in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field at the time appointed with David, and a little lad with him. And he said unto his lad, run, find out now the arrows which I shoot. And as the lad ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. And when the lad was come to the place of the arrow which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan cried after the lad and said, is not the arrow beyond thee? And Jonathan cried after the lad, make speed, haste, stay not. And Jonathan's lad gathered up the arrows and came to his master. But the lad knew not anything, only Jonathan and David knew the matter. And Jonathan gave his artillery unto his lad, and said unto him, go, carry them to the city. And as soon as the lad was gone, David arose out of a place toward the south, and fell on his face to the ground, and bowed himself three times. And they kissed one another, and wept one with another, until David exceeded. And Jonathan said to David, go in peace. Forasmuch as we have sworn, both of us, in the name of Yahweh, saying, Yahweh be between me and thee, and between my seed and thy seed forever. And he arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. Thank you, Brother Anthony. We look forward then to the words of our Brother Roger Lewis, to the theme, Jonathan the Intercessor. Earnest entreaty and bitter separation. Brother Roger.
Well, Brother Chairman, my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people. Well, after that stirring reading of what we're about to consider together this evening, we need then to give ourselves to the subject of Jonathan the intercessor, as we've seen before us in the second part of the 1st of Samuel chapter 20, as Jonathan now makes an earnest stand for his friend in the context of standing against his father Saul. Now, just before we carry on then in the record from verse 24, we perhaps need to make a point with regard to the arrangement that had been made between Jonathan and David earlier on in this chapter. You'll remember that in the fifth verse of the 1st of Samuel 20, that David said to Jonathan, "Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit with the king at meat, but let me go that I may hide myself in the field unto the third day at even. And if thy father at all miss me, then say, David earnestly asked leave of me that he might run to Bethlehem his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family." And the question, of course, is, was the arrangement of verses 5 and 6 a genuine one or merely the stratagem of lies? And one is inclined to consider that perhaps the arrangement that was first suggested by David, in being taken up and agreed to by Jonathan, was in fact implemented, and that David did make the journey to Bethlehem. Bear this in mind. In the 12th verse of this same chapter, whatever arrangements they have agreed to make, Jonathan commits Yahweh Elohim of Israel that he might be the witness to those arrangements. And given our understanding of the character of Jonathan, we consider it hardly likely that he would call down the blessing of God on an arrangement that he knew to be merely an outright lie. Now you'll notice in the 19th verse that the record says, "When thou hast stayed 3 days, then thou shalt go down quickly." And one might imagine from a surface reading of the 19th verse that the implication was that David indeed went into hiding for 3 days before going to the field as previously arranged. But in the Hebrew of the 19th verse, the literal text reads, "And the third you shall come quickly down." And the word "stayed" in verse 19 is not there in the original text. "On the third thou shalt come down quickly." When one considers the proximity of Gibeah to Bethlehem, you'll find that it was more than possible for David to very comfortably make the trip down to Bethlehem, to spend the time in a sacrificial meal with his family, and to return with more than adequate time to spare before the end of the third day had come and the time was upon him where he should hide himself in the field. And so I personally incline to the view that the arrangement once initially proposed was probably in fact carried out by the two friends, and that David in fact did journey to Bethlehem. Now in the 24th verse then, as we pick up the record this evening, the story says, "So David hid himself in the field, and when the new moon was come, the king sat him down to eat meat." And one might imagine here again that David has hid himself at the beginning of the 3 days, but I think really you see that the opening statement of verse 24 becomes a summary to the arrangements which concluded in verse 23. They were to make these arrangements. And so verse 24 says, "And so when the time came," in other words, at the end of the 3 days, "David hid himself in the field." Now, says the record, back to the story of the royal court. And so, with the colon break that's given to us in verse 24, the scene changes now back to the royal court and to the place of the king's presence. And we're told in the 24th verse that when the new moon was come, the king sat him down to eat meat. And the king sat upon his seat as at other times, even upon a seat by the wall. Now, why would a king sit upon a seat by the wall? Ah, you see, the reason why Saul was sitting by the wall was he was obviously fearful of assassination attempts. And if as a king you have your back to the wall and trusted friends alongside you, then there's no chance that anyone can come creeping up from behind to slay the king. And you see, I think that phrase, that the king sat upon a seat by the wall, gives us a clue as to the mind and spirit of Saul as we enter into this second part of the chapter, into the story of the confrontation between Saul and his son Jonathan. Saul is a man eaten out with obsession about his own position. He's a man fearful of assassination attempts. He's a man brooding on whether he can retain power or not. He's suspicious of everyone. He sits upon a seat by the wall. And the record goes on to say, in verse 25, and Jonathan arose. But the Revised Standard Version and the Jerusalem Bible and the New International Version and the Amplified Bible, in common with a number of other references, in fact render that phrase, Jonathan sat opposite. Not Jonathan arose, but Jonathan sat opposite. And you know, when you read verse 25 carefully, you get the picture of a table at which four people were sitting, two on this side and two on the other side. Let's read it together. Verse 25. The king sat upon his seat, as at other times even upon a seat by the wall, and Jonathan sat opposite, and Abner sat by Saul's side, and David's place was empty. Can you see, can you feel the four seats around that table there? There's four men that normally sit around that table. Two on one side and two on the other. And on the one side we have Saul and Abner, and opposite we have Jonathan and an empty place that normally belongs to David. And you see, that's very symbolic. Because you see, the whole point of this story will be to show that Jonathan is exactly in that position with relationship to his father. He is opposite his dad. That's exactly where he sits in this particular story. And isn't that interesting? That if in fact David, therefore, was the empty seat of the four, then he would have in fact been seated alongside Jonathan. Jonathan and David on the one side, and Saul and Abner on the other. Abner sat by Saul's side, says verse 25. Now, who is Abner? Well, we know, of course, from chapter 14 and verse 50, that Abner was, in fact, Saul's uncle. But he was more than Saul's uncle. He was a man whom Saul had invited to be the captain of the host. He was in charge of the army. And if one was ever to ask what was the spirit that moved and dominated Abner, we would have to say this, that he was committed to preserving the dynasty of the house of Kish upon the throne. That was Abner's moving spirit in life. He was absolutely committed to that ideal, that the house of Kish ought to be preserved upon the throne. Now we know that it's Abner later on in the second of Samuel chapter 2 verses 8 and 9 when Saul is dead. It's Abner that takes Ish-bosheth and sits him upon his throne as a puppet in Mahanaim in order that the house of Saul might continue to reign. That's Abner. Abner is a very dangerous man. And he's sitting alongside Saul opposite Jonathan. And the empty place, verse 25, belongs to David. And of course it was appropriate and right that David should sit at the king's table. He was, after all, one of the chief captains. He was one of the leaders of the army. He was the personal friend of the king's son. And in addition to that, he was the king's son-in-law. Because he had, of course, by this time married Michal. But his seat, says the record, is empty. And we have the scene set, therefore, for the tremendous tension that exudes out of this narrative as three men sit down to a meal together at the new moon. And verse 26 tells us, nevertheless, Saul spake not anything that day, for he thought, something hath befallen him. He is not clean. Surely he is not clean. The Jerusalem Bible says, Saul said, something's happened. Rotherham says, it's an accident. And you see, what Saul thought was that the reason for David's non-attendance at the feast on this day was because he was ceremonially defiled. When it says he's not clean, Rotherham's translation says, he's not clean because he has not been cleansed. The Septuagint translation says, he's not clean because he hath not been purified. And what Saul thought, you see, was that in some way, David had contracted ceremonial defilement and therefore was unable to attend the feast. It's an interesting reflection on the life and character of David that Saul, who was so bitter and hostile towards him, even Saul, in his brooding state of mind, that the first thing that Saul assumed as a reason for David's absence was some religious purpose. Something to do with religion. He's ceremonially defiled. That was the first thought that sprang into Saul's mind. Such was his esteem of the righteous character of David. But you see, there was a problem. You see, under the law, ceremonial defilement ended at even. Leviticus chapter 11, verse 24. Leviticus chapter 15, verse 10. Numbers chapter 19, verse 8 and verse 19. A number of references show that ceremonial defilement under the law ended at even. And therefore, we have the force of the 27th verse when it says, and it came to pass on the morrow, which was the second day of the month, that David's place was empty, and Saul said. So you see, what happened is Saul made the assumption of ceremonial defilement, which accounted for the first night, but when David wasn't there the next day, and he ought to have been cleansed by even the night before, Saul's suspicious, brooding mind immediately suspected now that something was afoot. And you see, I can just see Jonathan there as they sat down to the meal the night before. Sits down. Hello, Dad. Hello, Uncle. Awfully conscious of the empty seat alongside him. Every mouthful seemed to take an age to chew through. Wondering all night whether his father was going to say something. But at the end of the meal, walks out, relieved that nothing had occurred. But now it's the second night. And do you see what Saul says? He says in the 27th verse, wherefore cometh not the son of Jesse to meet? Oh, that's significant, isn't it? You see, up to this time in the divine record, Saul had always called him David. You see in chapter 19, verse 22, on the same page on the other side, then went Saul also to Ramah and came to a great well that is in situ and asked and said, where are Samuel and David? But such is the hostility of Saul now towards David. He's so upset, he's so eaten out about that man that he can't even bring himself to use that name. And so he says, wherefore cometh not the son of Jesse to meet? Now just track that through the story. Verse 30. Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said unto him, thou son of the perverse, rebellious woman, do not I know that thou hast chosen the son of Jesse to thine own confusion? Verse 31. For as long as the son of Jesse liveth upon the ground. Chapter 22. 1 Samuel chapter 22, verse 8. Saul says, none of you have showed me that all of you have conspired against me, and there is none that showeth me that my son hath made a league with the son of Jesse, says Saul. Can you see the bitterness in that term? Now, just to illustrate that that is definitely the spirit of the king, come to chapter 24. The 1 Samuel chapter 24. And David has now spoken to Saul. In fact, in the 11th verse, he says, moreover, my father. And verse 16 says, it came to pass when David had made an end of speaking these words unto Saul, that Saul said, is this thy voice, my son, David? He's back to normal now, you see. He's back to David again. Now, when Saul called David the son of Jesse, in the 1st of Samuel chapter 20 and verse 27. It marks, therefore, the beginning of that final peak, as it were, of hostility that Saul manifested against David. And you see what he calls him? The son of Jesse. And Jesse, well, Jesse is described in this record as the Bethlehemite. And that's Micah chapter 5, verse 2, isn't it? O Bethlehem, though thou be little among the thousands of Judah, an insignificant little town and an insignificant little family. It was a phrase of contempt, really, wasn't it? The son of Jesse. Who is he? And don't you think that Jonathan would have immediately picked up that change? Jonathan would have been quick to pick up that change of emphasis in his father's words. And I believe that not only did Jonathan pick it up, but it made him very on edge as he stood now to address his father in this particular story and to stand up for David, his friend. And so in the 1st of Samuel chapter 20 and verse 28 it says, "And Jonathan answered Saul." And that moment now that Jonathan had dreaded had come. And he was about to stand up to make earnest entreaty for his friend. And he wasn't looking forward to it. And he could see malice and bitterness written all over his father's face. And he could see his father watching him. And he knew that his father was aware of the relationship that he now did have with David. And he was scared not just for David, but scared for his father as to how far his father had gone down the road from which there would be no recovery. And to make matters worse, leaning across the table looking at him under bristling eyebrows is great Uncle Abner. And Jonathan is about to begin his entreaty for his friend. Oh, what a scene, brothers and sisters and young people, is set for that moment when Jonathan stands up to give this speech. And can you see he's nervous? You know, this record tells us that Jonathan is nervous. We're told in the 28th verse, the record says, "Jonathan answered Saul, saying, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem." Now you see those words in verse 28. That's verbatim from the 6th verse, isn't it? You see that? "David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem." That's straight from verse 6. Then he says in verse 29, he said, "Let me go, I pray thee, for our family hath a sacrifice in the city." Now that's verse 6 again, isn't it? "For there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family." So you see, up until the end of that first phrase, in verse 29, the words of Jonathan have been repeated verbatim from what they'd agreed on in the 6th verse. But Jonathan doesn't stop there. What Jonathan says is, reading from the 28th verse again, he says, "Well, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem, and he said, let me go, I pray thee, for our family have a sacrifice in the city." And he looks at his father. "And my brother, he hath commanded me to be there." And he looks at great Uncle Abner. "And now, if I've found favour in thine eyes, let me get away, I pray thee, and see my brethren. And therefore, he cometh not unto the king's table." Can you see that Jonathan's nervous in this story? He's really on edge, isn't he? He goes on and on and on because he senses that the two men standing up or sitting opposite him at the table don't believe this story. And as is so often the case, when a person's under tension and they suspect somehow that the other person isn't quite convinced, you tend to go on and on and you add a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. But he made a mistake, you see, Jonathan. He made a bad mistake because, you see, in the middle of verse 29, he used a word he never ought to have used, not with Saul in the frame of mind that he had, because he says, "If I've found favour in thine eyes, let me get away, I pray thee." You see that word "get away"? It's the word "malak"
in the Hebrew, M-A-L-A-T, and it means to escape by slipperiness. Oh, that wasn't the right word to use. Rotherham translates that word to slip away. Green translates the phrase, let me escape. In fact, it's the same word translated in the 1 Samuel chapter 19 and verse 10. Saul sought to smite David even to the wall with a javelin, but he slipped away out of Saul's presence and he smote the javelin to the wall, and David fled and escaped that night. It's the same word translated in Daniel 11 when the king of the north comes down, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. It's a word that means to, as it were, slip out of the clutches of someone at the last minute. That wasn't a good word for Jonathan to use, was it? He let slip, as it were, the real feelings between himself and his friend. And immediately, as a result of that choice of words, perhaps, we're told in the 30th verse that Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. And he said unto him, thou son of the perverse, rebellious woman, do not I know that thou hast chosen the son of Jesse to thine own confusion and unto the confusion of thy mother's nakedness? You'll notice that in the authorized version, it simply says, thou son of the perverse, rebellious, or as the margin says, thou son of perverse rebellion. It can be read in two different ways in terms of the textual phrasing of the Hebrew. But there would appear to be an implication where in some way here, Saul reproached Jonathan by reference to his mother. Thou son of perverse rebellion. In fact, the Jerusalem Bible says, thou son of a wanton. You see, Saul was unable really to reproach Jonathan any further, so he vilified him by insulting his mother, which was the worst insult you could offer an Oriental. Now, do you know who his mother was? Chapter 14, verse 50. Let's go and have a look at that. Reading from verse 49. Who was Jonathan's mother? Well, we're told in the 49th verse of chapter 14. Now, the sons of Saul were Jonathan and Ashui and Melchishua, and the names of his two daughters were these, the name of the firstborn Merab and the name of the younger Michal, and the name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam. You know that Ahinoam means brother of pleasantness. And you don't want to be confused by the use of the term brother, because the word brother here in the Hebrew is simply being used in the context of that which stands related to something. You're a brother of something, you're related to it. It doesn't necessarily convey gender. She was that which was related to pleasantness. And I'm sure she was. In fact, when you stop and think about the character of Jonathan, one would imagine that his sweetness and his humility and his courage and his godliness all sprang from his mother, and certainly not from his father. And that maybe Ahinoam likewise had stood against the worst excesses of her husband and had herself incurred the wrath of Saul, the king, in his brooding discontent. It was a most unfair thing for Saul to say, wasn't it, to a righteous son like Jonathan. As one writer has rightly said, more fair would it have been, more true would it have been, if Saul had said, thou son of a perverse, rebellious father. Because that's the reality of the situation, isn't it? And so in the 1 Samuel chapter 20 and verse 30, Saul endeavours to heap reproach upon his own son's back because of his hostility towards the son of Jesse. Do I not know, he says in the record, that thou hast chosen? The Septuagint renders that verse or that phrase, thou art an accomplice. The Jerusalem Bible says thou art in league with. Rotherham says thou art a confederate of. And the thing that upset Saul here was the relationship between his son and the son of Jesse. And so he says in verse 31, "For as long as the son of Jesse liveth upon the ground, thou shalt not be established, nor thy kingdom. Wherefore now send and fetch him unto me, for he shall surely die." You know, isn't that a remarkable statement in that verse? As long as the son of Jesse liveth, thou shalt not be established, nor thy kingdom. But hadn't Samuel said in chapter 13, verse 14, "Thy kingdom shall not continue"? And hadn't Samuel said in chapter 15 and verse 28, "The kingdom is rent from thee"? You know, verse 31 tells us that Saul did not accept and did not believe the pronouncements of Samuel. And you know what Saul's really saying in this verse? Read it carefully. "As long as the son of Jesse liveth upon the ground, thou shalt not be established, nor thy kingdom." He says, look, son, there are two different choices here, and they're mutually exclusive, and you've got to work out what stands as a priority in your life. Now, this is Saul's argument in the 31st verse. He really says to Jonathan, you've got to make a choice. You either have to give up your friendship with David, or give up the hope of inheriting the material possessions of the kingdom. "Don't you understand that, son?" he said. "Can't you see what's happening? You've got to make a choice. What are you going to place first in life? Material considerations or spiritual ones?" That's the challenge of verse 31, isn't it? You see, what Saul said was, secure your kingdom. Get your possessions sorted out. Establish your power base. And then worry about the truth later on. Moffat says, "As long as the son of Jesse liveth upon the ground, neither you nor your kingdom will be stable." The Jerusalem Bible says, "Neither your person nor your royal rights will be secure." Get your priorities sorted out, says Saul. But Jonathan's spirit was, my relationship with the beloved is the first thing. And I believe that we ought to put the things of the spirit first, and only after that will all other things find their place. And the drama of the 1st of Samuel chapter 20 and verse 31 is the drama of a hopeless confrontation between father and son who were poles apart as to what ought to be the priority in life in the truth. And isn't that the challenge for every one of us? Isn't that the challenge facing us today? It's the principle, really, of loyalty, isn't it? Being loyal to Christ. You know, every day of our life, we're faced with that sort of dilemma. Proverbs chapter 17 and verse 17 says, "A friend loveth at all times, and a brother is born for adversity." True friendship is not affected by changes of circumstance or by trial or adversity. It's a thing of constancy. Proverbs chapter 18 and verse 24 says, "A man of many companions may come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticketh closer than a brother." And you know, the amazing thing about the choice that faced Jonathan in this verse was it's not even the choice that we might imagine was open to him. You see, we would tend to say, oh well, you know, Matthew 6 verse 33, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you." That wasn't what would happen as far as Jonathan was concerned. Jonathan knew that the result of whatever decision he made in this story would be, "Seek ye first the kingdom of David and his righteousness, and all these things shall be taken away from you. Wasn't that Jonathan's position? And he had to decide what came first in life. Isn't that what we've got to decide? And just look at this passage here. In a psalm that was composed by David later on, concerning those who are the rightful inhabitants of the kingdom. Who shall abide in thy tabernacle, says Psalm 15. He that backbiteth not with his tongue, nor does evil to his friend, nor endureth a reproach against his friend, in whose eyes a vile person is condemned, but he honoureth them that fear Yahweh. He that sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not. Isn't that Jonathan's position right there? Are you prepared to swear to your own hurt concerning loyalty to the beloved and change not? It's the challenge of the truth for all of us, isn't it? Are we really loyal to Christ? Do we have the measure of Jonathan's spirit? So you have a young person and they're told, oh, well, you know, bit of tertiary education. Well, you really ought to get that done first. Worry about baptism later on. Nobody's saying that many of our young people don't take study. What we're saying is, if that study is seen to conflict with the truth, what's your priority? There are many people that have undertaken that sort of thing after the end of their normal school days, but they've got to somehow sort out the priority of the truth over against those things. Well, I've got the opportunity of a new job. The only problem is I'll be away every Wednesday night, Bible class night, but it's good pay. What's your priority? There's a study weekend on. Other people will go, I've got other things to do. You see, only we can tell in our own hearts whether we truly are loyal to the truth and loyal to Christ. There's 100 little things in everyday life where we're tested day by day on whether we are loyal to Christ, as Jonathan was to David. And sometimes that loyalty might be at the expense of our own position and our own advancement and our own material well-being. And we've got to decide whether to be like Jonathan or not. And so you have this dramatic confrontation across the table as Saul looks at his son and says, listen, son, sort your priorities out, but it's one or the other. And what was Jonathan going to do? Well, verse 32 tells us, and Jonathan answered Saul his father and said unto him, wherefore shall he be slain? What hath he done? You see, when it says in verse 32 that Jonathan answered his father, in fact, when you read the record carefully, he never did answer his father's comments at the start of verse 31. You see that there? As long as the son of Jesse liveth upon the ground, thou shalt not be established, nor thy kingdom. Jonathan never, ever does answer that statement. As far as he was concerned, it was absolutely invalid and not in accordance with the spirit of the truth. The only thing that Jonathan takes up by way of answer was the latter statement, wherefore now send and fetch him, for he shall die. And that's what Jonathan answers when he says, wherefore shall he be slain? What hath he done? And so in the 32nd verse here, we have that marvelous spirit whereby Jonathan stands up now and earnestly entreats as an intercessor for his friend. And he pleads David's cause. And he pleads it with frankness, and he pleads it with generosity, and he never needed to answer his father on those other matters, because as soon as he opened his mouth and said what he did say, he had given an answer to his father of which of the two he chose. It was really the spirit, wasn't it, of Matthew chapter 19. We might just turn to that one, Matthew chapter 19. Isn't this the spirit of what Jonathan did on this occasion? You either choose the son of Jesse, or you choose the rewards of the kingdom. Matthew 19, verse 29. And everyone that hath forsaken houses, or brethren, or sisters, or father, or mother, or wife, or children, or lands, for my name's sake, shall receive an hundredfold and shall inherit everlasting life. And Jonathan knew that if he made the choice of standing for David, that his father was right. He would give up the material possessions of the kingdom. And that he'd have to give them up for the hope of everlasting life yet to come in another age. That's the spirit of Jonathan's decision on this occasion, isn't it? You know, there's an interesting phrase in the book of Ecclesiastes which, to my mind, sums up the spirit of this moment when he stood against his father. I won't give you the reference, I'll just read it to you. Where the word of a king is, there is power. And who may say unto him, what doest thou? Ecclesiastes 8, verse 4. Who can ever say in front of a king, what are you doing? But that's exactly what Jonathan does on this occasion, isn't it? Fearless of danger to himself, why should he be slain? What hath he done? And he makes the stand of loyalty for his dear friend. Come to John chapter 7. The loyalty of the disciples for Christ. That spirit of fearless and brave defence for the truth and for the beloved. John chapter 7, verse 47. Then answered them the Pharisees. This is the Saul class of Christ's day, isn't it? Those that brooded over their power. Are ye also deceived? Have any of the rulers or of the Pharisees believed on him? But this people who knoweth not the law accursed. Nicodemus saith unto them, he that came to Jesus by night being one of them, but now a disciple, doth our Lord judge any man before it? Hear him and knoweth what he doeth? Isn't that the spirit of Jonathan? Why should he be slain? What hath he done? And Nicodemus in his own day stood up with exactly that same spirit of loyalty for the beloved and made a stand against the Saul of his own day. That's loyalty, isn't it? We're asked to do that. We're asked to do that if we're to be faithful in the truth. Back to the 1st of Samuel, chapter 20. Verse 33 tells us that as a result of the stand of Jonathan on this occasion, it says that Saul cast a javelin at him to smite him, whereby Jonathan knew that it was determined of his father to slay David. Why do you think Saul cast a javelin at Jonathan, his own dear son, in verse 33? There were two reasons. The first reason is because he knew that he had no answer to the two questions Jonathan's just given him. Why should he be slain? What's he done? And because Saul's got no answer, he picks up the spear and throws it. Because he's got absolutely no answer, and he knows he's got no answer. But you see, I think the other reason was that, you see, Saul was so consumed with malice against David that at that particular moment, just for a moment, he hated Jonathan. He loved his own son. You know, the record's very clear in that there was a tremendous bond and an affinity between Saul and Jonathan. But for this moment, he hated his son because he was confederate with the son of Jesse. And that's a lesson for all the disciples, isn't it? that the disciples of Christ will experience a measure of trial in their own lives because of loyalty to him. Remember the words of Jesus in John, "If they have hated me, they will hate you." And so a spear was thrust at Jonathan. Do you see the paradox of verse 33? Isn't it an amazing thing? You see, it says that Saul cast a javelin at him to smite him, whereby Jonathan knew that it was determined of his father to slay David. You see the paradox of the verse? A javelin comes whistling past his head, thuds into the wall. Jonathan says, "I think my father, it wants to slay David." What a paradox. No thought of danger or concern for himself. Because his father cast a javelin to smite him, he knew that it was determined of his father to slay David. That's loyalty, isn't it? Absolutely absorbed in David's cause was this man in this story. And so verse 34 tells us, "And so Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and did eat no meat the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had done him shame." Do you know the Septuagint translation renders that phrase, "Jonathan sprang up from the table in great anger." Rotherham says, "Jonathan rose up from the table in a glow of anger." Do you know what, brothers and sisters and young people? He had his mother's sweetness, but a little bit of his father's spark in him, did this boy. And he sprang up from the table in a glow of anger because of what Saul had said about his friend. But you see what the verse says. What verse 34 tells us is that Jonathan did not retaliate. He went out, and mark this, he took his anger with him. He walked out of the room. The record says he did eat no meat. The implication of that phrase is therefore that he arose from the table and left the room. He didn't try to fight hatred with hatred. When he was reviled, he reviled not again. This is Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 7. "Go from the presence of a foolish man when thou perceivest not in him the lips of knowledge." And Jonathan stood up and walked out. And you see, what we have in these two verses, verses 33 and 34, is an amazing contrast between the anger of two men. One is the anger of the spirit, righteous anger, and the other is the anger of the flesh. One is absolutely unrestrained and ungovernable. A javelin is thrown. The other is principled and under tremendous self-control. And isn't that the spirit? Self-control. Don't we all need that? Ephesians chapter 4 verse 26 says, "Be ye angry and sin not, neither let the sun go down upon your wrath." Another translation of that same phrase says, "If you are angry, do not let your anger lead you into sin. Do not let sunset find you still nursing it." Proverbs 16, verse 32, "He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that ruleth his spirit than he that taketh a city." And that's the spirit of Jonathan, isn't it? He ruled his own spirit as he walked away from that table. James 1, 19 and 20, "Let every man be slow to wrath, for the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God." And that's what Jonathan was interested in upholding. 2 Peter 1, verses 5 to 6, "Add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge, and to knowledge self-control." Proverbs 14, verse 29, he that is slow to wrath is of great understanding. And you know, there's lots of times in ecclesial life where conflicts escalate and hasty, rash, bitter, strong, angry words are sometimes said, and afterwards combatants wish they'd never said them. Jonathan never fell into that trap. He stood up. It would have been so easy to criticize his father in the presence of all the court, but he didn't say a word. That's self-control. And yet, you know what was really at the back of what Jonathan did here? He was really showing tremendous self-courage, wasn't he? Tremendous courage. Because in walking out, he let the whole court know where he did stand on that issue. But he said it, he let them know without saying a word. I put spiritual considerations before material ones, says Jonathan. And he walked out. You see what it says at the end of verse 34? He was grieved for David because his father had done him shame. And you wonder whether the him of verse 34 is because his father had done him, that is Jonathan, shame, or David's shame. But I think clearly in the record it ought to be David, shouldn't it? He was grieved for David because his father had done David shame. In fact, the New International Version says, renders that quite nicely when it says, because he was grieved at his father's shameful treatment of David. And you know what's remarkable about that verse? That Jonathan is the one who stood to lose everything by being one with David. Jonathan had to resign his personal ambitions and make David's hope his hope. Isn't that a type of the disciples? Those who are prepared to resign their own ambitions and make the hope of Christ their hope? If you ever want a measuring stick for our loyalty to Christ, look at Jonathan's stand in this chapter as he earnestly entreats for his good friend. And every day, my dear brothers and sisters and my dear young people, we go out into the courts of the world. And there are times when the leaders and the rulers of this world shamefully treat Christ. You know, the silly jokes in the lunchroom. Do you laugh at them? Or are you grieved that they have done shame to Christ? Do we stand and make a stand for Christ whenever he's shamed or the principles of the truth are reviled? That's the spirit of Jonathan, isn't it? Now you just think about the drama of this verse. You see, I think what happened was this. You see, Saul picked up his javelin and threw it. Maybe a servant restored the javelin to him. Jonathan stands up, springs up, looks at his father with blazing eyes, and then walks out. And as he walked out, my dear brothers and sisters, he offered his back to his father. He said, that's how loyal I am to David. He offered his back to the smiters. Said, thrust me through if you want to, but I stand for David. What a remarkable man he was. And verse 35 says that it came to pass in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field at the time appointed with David and a little lad with him. A little lad, says the record. And no doubt the little lad was chosen because he was only young of age, he wouldn't be suspicious of the circumstances of the little game now that was about to be played with regard to the bow and the arrows. He would dutifully do what he was asked to do as a servant of the royal son. And he obviously wasn't old enough to have thought, well, I wonder what's going on here. There's something strange. He was only a little lad. So he wouldn't be suspicious. Verse 36 says, he said unto his lad, run, and find out now the arrows which I shoot. And as the lad ran, he shot an arrow beyond him, straight over his head. And when the lad was come to the place of the arrow which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan cried after the lad and said, is not the arrow beyond thee? And Jonathan cried after the lad, make speed, haste, stay not. You know, in verse 37, when he said, is not the arrow beyond thee? If you come back to verse 22, that was the agreed statement for David, wasn't it? If I say thus unto the young man, behold, the arrows are beyond thee, go thy way, for Yahweh hath sent thee away. So you see, when in verse 37 he cried out after the lad and said, is not the arrow beyond thee? That was the message to David that all hope of reconciliation with Saul was lost. It's no good, my dear friend. It's no good. And then in the 38th verse, Jonathan cried after the lad, make speed, haste, stay not. The Jerusalem Bible says, be quick, hurry, do not stand about. But you see, while the lad thought that those words were being directed to him, they were really a message for David, weren't they? Be quick, hurry, do not stand about. Speed thee, brother, on thy way. And verse 38 says, and Jonathan's lad gathered up the arrows and came to his master. Only mentions one arrow that was fired, but we know from verse 20 that there were three, in fact, that Jonathan was intending to shoot on that occasion, as no doubt he is. He did. Three after the other, each over the head of the lad. Are they not beyond thee? Run along, quick! Verse 39 says, but the lad knew not anything, only Jonathan and David knew the matter. And there's an interesting statement, verse 39. Only Jonathan and David knew the matter. You know, that's the principle of true friendship, isn't it? The principle of trust. Remember Psalm 41, verse 9? Mine own familiar friend in whom I trusted. The word familiar is the word shalom. That which brings safety. Mine own safe friend. What's a safe friend, brothers and sisters, and young people? It's a friend that you can safely confide in. There's a lovely statement in Job chapter 19, verse 19, where Job speaks about all my inward friends. And the margin says, the men of my secret. That's what a true friend is, isn't it? The men of our secrets. Proverbs chapter 17, verse 13 says, a talebearer revealeth secrets, but he that is of a faithful spirit concealeth the matter. Proverbs 17, verse 9 says, he that covereth a transgression seeketh love, but he that repeateth a matter separateth very friends. And you see, the record says here that only Jonathan and David knew the matter. True friendship doesn't betray confidences. And David knew that he could place implicit trust always in Jonathan and that nobody else would ever know. You know, there are some people that really want to have a friend in the truth, but they can't keep secrets. If you can't keep secrets, you'll never find very many true friends. You've got to learn to guard the doors of your mouth. It's a principle, isn't it, of trust in one another. You need to practice that. So often in ecclesial life, things are said to this brother or to that sister that ought not to be said, that were spoken in confidence to you. Sometimes that betrayal even occurs in the context of marriage, where brothers or sisters run around the ecclesia and talk about things their husband's done or shouldn't have done or ought to be doing. That's not the basis of true friendship. True friendship respects confidences. Only Jonathan and David knew the matter. Verse 40, and the record says, and Jonathan gave his artillery unto his lad, and said unto him, go, carry them to the city.
Artillery?
Well, of course, it was his bow and his arrows, wasn't it? It's the same word translated in the next chapter, chapter 21 and verse 8, when he says, when David says, I haven't brought my weapons with me. And so the bow and the arrow are handed to the lad. And having handed them to the lad, go carry them to the city. Verse 41 says, as soon as the lad was gone, David arose out of his place toward the south and fell on his face to the ground. Now you think, if they went through the matter of the arrows, why then did David suddenly appear at the end of the story? And you see, obviously what had happened was this. You see, the whole stratagem of the arrows was designed to protect David in case Jonathan was being spied upon. So as Jonathan went out into the field with his little lad, there was always the chance that a man such as Doeg the Edomite or some other retainer of the king might be tracking along close behind. And so the matter of the arrows and the calling out about the arrows being beyond and to haste and to be quick about it was a means by which Jonathan could communicate to David even if there was someone at hand. But having gone through the exercise, Jonathan must have no doubt looked around, kept a sharp eye, and realized that in fact the coast was clear. There was nobody with them. They were safe. There was opportunity. And so he sends the lad away, pats him on the shoulder, good lad. Off you go now, son. Run along to the city. Take those to my room. And verse 41 says, as soon as the lad was gone. And no doubt both Jonathan and David sought this opportunity now for last words together. As soon as the lad was gone, David arose out of his place toward the south. Rollohims translates the phrase, David arose from beside the mound. Cross references back to the 19th verse when he was to remain by the mound. You know, what a dramatic moment that verse must have been between these two friends. David stands up and comes around from behind the mound. And as he comes round, Jonathan starts to walk towards him. There's nobody else. They're all alone. They know it's safe. And all of a sudden, David deliberately prostrates himself before Jonathan. He bows down. And he doesn't just do it once. He does it again and again. He does it three times. He prostrates himself before Jonathan. Three times. And you see, what David was doing as he bowed himself before Jonathan, what he was really saying was, I've got no ambition to assume the throne in your place, dear friend. Wasn't that a lovely spirit? You see, they loved each other, these two men. They loved each other. And just as Jonathan sought to uphold his friend's right to the throne and gave his robe and his kingly garments, so now David in return shows the same spirit and bows before Jonathan. I've got no desire to rule in your place. And isn't that the spirit of John 13 verses 4 and 5 when Christ bows before his disciples and washes their feet? In the same spirit of humility that David now shows to Jonathan. And having bowed himself, they ran together. And Green's interlinear translation translates the balance of that verse, and they kissed each one his friend and wept each one upon his friend until David exceeded. And the word exceeded here means to weep loudly. David broke down completely. In the end, he just couldn't restrain himself. His whole body was convulsed with sobs. The younger man of the two, more stricken with uncertainty, David broke down completely in the story and weeps loudly on the shoulder of his dear friend. What a moment that must have been. And one can imagine Jonathan here choked with emotion. Because you see, there was a great tragedy here, wasn't there? Because you see, as far as they knew, they might never, ever meet again. They didn't know what lay ahead of them. All they knew was that the most wonderful friendship that either had was about to be ripped asunder. And Jonathan says, in verse 42, he says to David, go in peace, Forasmuch as we have sworn both of us in the name of Yahweh, saying, Yahweh, be between me and thee, and between my seed and thy seed forever. And who is it that takes charge of the situation? Why, Jonathan, of course. The older of the two, the wiser, the more mature. You see, all the way through the story, Jonathan stands as the greater man, and David is the younger, in need of guidance, in need of comfort, in need of counsel. And doesn't that make it all the more remarkable, in view of the greatness of Jonathan in the story, that he's the one that's prepared to bow before David? And it's Jonathan that takes charge and gently, again, no doubt, puts his hands on his friend's shoulder and says, go in peace. He promises David that there would be eternal unity, eternal affinity between them, because Yahweh would be between them. We've both sworn in the name of Yahweh, saying, Yahweh be between us. I don't know what's going to happen, David, no more than you do, but I do know this, that Yahweh shall be between us, and we will ever be in fellowship together as friends, whatever that might bring. I believe that. You see where he says there, between my seed and thy seed forever? Jonathan actually uses that phrase three times in this story. Verse 15, thou shalt not cut off thy kindness from my house forever. Verse 23, Yahweh be between thee and me forever. And now verse 42, between my seed and thy seed forever, for the old lamb. We will always be together ultimately in that age to come, he says. Now you stop and think about this story. Three complaints by David. Three denials by Jonathan. Three statements of love. He loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. 3 days, three arrows, 3 times David bows before Jonathan, 3 times Jonathan says, we have a friendship forever. Everything about the story of this couple is coloured by the idea of divine perfection, which the number 3 stands for. The whole of this story is saturated with the number 3. And I can imagine what it must have ended like. A final hug, scalding bitter tears, 2 broken hearts, and an older man that sent a younger away. You know, brothers and sisters and young people, every jot and tittle in the record is important. You see what it says at the end? Just look at this. And he arose and departed, that's David, and Jonathan went into the city. But do you notice in between the two, there's a colon? You stop and think about that. And you see, what that's really telling us is that the one went before the other. I can just see that scene. Can you see it? And David arose and departed. Colon. And Jonathan watched him go, you see. Watched his friend walk away, until he grew small in the distance. Goodbye, dear friend. Yahweh be with thee. Go in peace. And when David's body grew small as a shadow on the horizon, Jonathan turned round and went back into the city, back to his father, back to the royal courts, back to the madness, back to the hatred. Which of the two do you think had the more difficult task? And Jonathan knew that as a result of his relationship with this boy, his life would never be the same again. Jonathan the intercessor. Earnest entreaty and bitter separation. Friendship with Christ inevitably begins to separate us from those
hostile to him. Yet true friendship is constant, unaffected by changes in circumstance. It is marked in the disciples by that stand of loyalty that yields first place to Christ. Jonathan revealed this spirit by being fearless and earnest in entreaty for his friend and utterly thoughtless of danger or deprivation to himself. Right conduct in the truth demands the discipline of self-control. Those who practice friendship also practice trust, learning to give and receive secrets and guard them faithfully. And David's secrets, my dear brothers and sisters and young people, were truly safe in the heart of Jonathan this day as he watched his friend walk away. We have yet to meet them again in the depths and dark despair of the woods. But at least in the story of this chapter, we've seen the marvellous spirit of a man, empty enough to ignore himself, to be utterly consumed for his friend's cause on that day when he stood and spoke righteous words to his father of earnest entreaty, Jonathan, the intercessor.